We turn now on our agenda to the consent items. First, a brief explanation about our consent agenda. As you know, the Executive and Planning Committee places items on the consent agenda in consideration of council meeting time and also to ensure that the work of council and its many advisory committees can be as effective as possible in setting policy and implementing solutions to issues facing the courts and our overall system. Placement on the consent agenda, however, in no way reflects the significance of the proposal, and prior to any council meeting, any member may request that an item be removed from the consent agenda to the discussion agenda. I also want to take this opportunity in our year-end meeting to acknowledge all the judicial officers, justice system partners, and the AOC staff that work on all the consent items that appear on our Judicial Council meeting agendas. For this meeting alone, We have 22 items and consent items, and 65 of our colleagues were prepared to come here today to present to us on these items and answer our questions. These consent items also reflect the depth and breadth and continuing issues that council and its committees address on behalf of all Californians throughout the state and the issues they face relating to the diverse matters as reflected in the consent agenda. Having had no requests from council members to move an item from consent to discussion, on your amended agenda, we approve these proposals and recommendations. We now turn to our discussion agenda, which begins with the judicial branch update. This is not an action item. There are no materials. It's a presentation by Judge Jarr, Judge Earl, Mr. Alan Carlson, and Mr. Kurt Soderlund. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chief. As you know, the governor's annual budget message to the legislature, which this year is due on or about January 10th, embraces not only the executive office and department's budgets, but also that of the judicial branch. Customarily, our branch engages in discussions by way of the Judicial Council with the governor's office and the Department of Finance in advance of the publication of that budget message in an effort to ensure that the needs of the branch are well met. The discussions concerning the upcoming fiscal 13-14 year have been ongoing for a time. As you may remember, in fact, last summer, when the 12-13 budget was concluded by agreement between the executive and legislative branches, our branch was not actually included in the negotiations that led to the agreement. And so, in an effort to improve our dialogue with, communication with, and regular relations with the executive branch, Jody Patel, then serving as your interim administrative director, established a monthly business meeting relationship with the Department of Finance, which has been ongoing for some time now. As you're also aware, during the course of conversations with the Department of Finance regarding the upcoming budget, the treatment of trial court fund balances arose to our surprise in that discussion process. The budget agreement that was reached last July between the legislature and the executive branch contained trailer bill language, the plain meaning of which to us and to the stakeholders who spoke on our behalf in the budget process last year, enabled the trial courts on an individual basis, using their best business judgment to address individual challenges and concerns, two full fiscal years, 12-13 and 13-14, to pay down, if you will, their fund balances to 1% of budget as a glide path, we've called it, or cushion against the reduced support from the general fund for our courts, so that an orderly reduction in services could be accomplished without dramatic dislocations to our general public. The recent communication from the Department of Finance that we received, however, as you know from the email that I ultimately distributed, indicated its view that the fund balances were subject to being utilized in the actual general fund restoration process for fiscal 13-14. There are complications associated with the budgeting process, but the net effect of that different understanding than the understanding we had is a $200 million additional reduction in the aggregate state support of court operations for fiscal 13-14, which would have, of course, a catastrophic impact on not just the courts, but the plans that they've made to scale down services to the general public. As a consequence of that communication, we scheduled an appointment with the Director of Finance to seek to iron it out. And during the course of that meeting, it was confirmed that indeed it was the understanding of the Department of Finance that the agreement that they had with the governor's office, of course, struck with the legislature last year, enabled that approach. A duty arose in my judgment that this new information immediately be conveyed not simply to the Judicial Council, but to the trial courts, which led to the email that everyone has received. And I will tell you that I did inform the Director of Finance at the conclusion of our meeting that, in my view, that was required. The Executive Office and the Chief continue in dialogue with the Department of Finance and with the Governor's Office regarding this and other budget issues. It has been constructive dialogue, in my view. Those conversations continued this week, as the Chief has already indicated in a lengthy meeting that she and Governor Brown had previously planned, but which was taken up all hour and a half of it, essentially, by the current budget circumstance and this new issue relative to fund balances. You should be aware that the Governor and the Chief were engaged throughout the entirety of the discussion. The governor was obviously inquisitive, attentive, and concerned, and I believe it is reasonable to say that we should have optimism in his interest in scrutinizing this dire circumstance and assisting the branch in solving the problems that lie ahead. A number of our branch members and stakeholders stand ready to assist in the advocacy that will, of course, begin after the governor's budget proposal is published on January 10th. And we look forward to going forward once we see what the proposal is. Of course, it is our fervent hope that the proposal will be much more, shall we say, hopeful for the judicial branch when it's first published. We recognize, I think all of us, that even with the passage of Proposition 30, the Department of Finance and the governor have a substantial challenge facing them in balancing the state's entire budget for fiscal 13-14. And I think we also all recognize that while our branch absorbs less than 1% of general fund dollars in the budgeting process, even such a comparatively small segment of government such as ours must be scrutinized in that process. That said, the effectiveness of all government operations and all government programs depend on civil order and on the maintenance of public peace, which in turn flow from the administration of the rule of law. In other words, the functions entrusted to us in the judicial branch are vital to all other government activities. At present, we receive almost daily reports of curtailment of court services in order for courts to balance budgets as they continue this glide path down to a most unwelcome reset level. Bear in mind that these reports are the result of business plans that were put in effect long before the $200 million fund balance issue arose. There are many examples. I'll just select at random one that we all saw arise this week and on which Presiding Judge Slough of the San Bernardino County Superior Court and Stephen Nash, a very able court executive and former finance officer of the administrative office, reported. Previously, San Bernardino Superior Court, which of course provides service over a geographical territory that is larger than most of the states in the Union, announced the closure of its Chino courthouse due to budget problems. We just now learned this week that, in addition, three more court facilities will be closed, including the facility in Barstow, which houses four court departments and has 22 staff members loyally serving the citizens in that remote area of the county. The community is not a wealthy one, and it has, to say the least, limited public transportation. What that translates into, I'm informed, is something on the order for many of the citizens in that portion of San Bernardino County, a one-way trip to the nearest court of something on the order of 175 miles or 3 hours each way. Now, what does that mean? For small businesses, which have routinely as an unwanted but real part of their businesses, commercial disputes of a very routine nature, they no longer have a forum in which to resolve those disputes. And, of course, there is the following concern that they have about engaging in new transactions with people when it's recognized that the rule of law will be withdrawn in substance and effect from their activities. What do we say to the tenant who has dealings with a landlord that are sharp practices and is looking to be evicted? That tenant will be unlikely to receive relief or scrutiny by a court of the dispute. The other side of the coin is the small landlord who is perhaps having his or her tenancy abused or degraded by a tenant who's violating the contract between them. How will that tenant be dispossessed so that the landlord can retake possession of the premises without adjacency of a court of law? We then begin to think in terms of the domestic violence restraining orders that are sought and required, usually on very short notice, of custody and visitation disputes which routinely occur in our society and concerning which our courts provide structure for peaceable organization as families adjust and change, and most importantly, of course, as children's needs are placed first. What of the police officers who issue traffic citations and have to travel 3 hours to give 10 minutes worth of testimony in a traffic trial? These examples, of course, are but few of the many that come to mind when, in substance and effect, the withdrawal of the judicial branch from a geographical area is contemplated. It is obviously our hope that this May 13 implementation plan can be interrupted by a change in the circumstances in our budget, but plainly it is not to be undervalued. We know Fresno County, for example, has taken similar steps, and the people who are served in the Coalinga area on the west side of the valley are, as a consequence, in effect, without the services of a court. Los Angeles, of course, has reported an extensive reorganization plan, which, due to its sheer size and complexity, will go into place in July of this year, and it's plain what that means for virtually all unlimited civil cases other than complex litigation. So these are some of the challenges that we face, and bear in mind that these activities, once again, all took place before we learned of the so-called $200 million fund balance difference of opinion. So we continue to work with the governor to encourage a fresh examination of the services we provide, which I think we can very comfortably submit are a foundation piece for the successful society that we have all enjoyed and perhaps many of us in our communities have taken for granted. We're very fortunate to have the fine assistance of the presiding judges through our Standing Advisory Committee, J. chaired by Judge Earle, and simultaneously the assistance of our court executives, organized by Alan Carlson's Court Executives Advisory Committee. And though not noted in the agenda by Judge Hardcastle and the California Judges Association, which has already made known its concerns in this significant event that popped up in the last 2 weeks. So with that, Judge Earle.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Judge Starr. As you have mentioned, the result of reduced funding to the judicial branch over the last 5 years or so has had significant impact upon the trial courts. And in response, trial courts have had to reduce their operating expenses to adjust to this decrease in funding. Trial courts have always used their fund balances to mitigate the reduction in costs that have been imposed upon us, but largely fund balances have been used to address cash flow issues that might arise throughout the year and pay for large infrastructure projects that courts have, including case management systems that are desperately needed in each county. Beginning on July 1st, however, of this year, with the governor's trailer bill language that trial courts would no longer be permitted to carry over fund balances yearly, and that taking place beginning in fiscal year 2014, courts have had to accelerate the mitigation of these expenses and the use of their fund balances to offset those. So you can understand that when your announcement came that there may be a change and that those fund balances would actually not be permitted to be carried over after the end of this fiscal year, there was some heightened concern from the trial courts that they would now have to rapidly change the budget plans that they had made over the last year or so to accommodate this. One of the reactions of the trial courts and the presiding judge committee has been to address and prepare information about what the trial courts have been doing, how they've been using their fund balances, what their budget plans have been, and also to explain what the impacts of those have had upon the courts. You've alluded to a few impacts throughout the state, including San Bernardino, but there are stories like that in almost every county of services or programs that they have had to eliminate. It's not just limited to large courts. It's across the state, frankly. So we have rallied, so to speak, to try to portray what further budget cuts would mean, what the what it would mean if we were to lose our reserves at the end of this year as opposed to the end of the following fiscal year, as everyone has planned. And we are here to do whatever else you need to send the message and demonstrate that we believe we have been fiscally responsible, which is why we had accumulate reserves to begin with. So anything else you need us to do, we're happy to do.
Thank you, Judge Earle. I also want to welcome to the panel, as previously alluded to but not mentioned, that is the president of CJA, Judge Alan Hardcastle. Judge Hardcastle?
All right. Thank you, Chief, and good morning. And I want to welcome my friend and my state senator, Noreen Evans, who just joined us this morning. Good morning.
Good to see you.
I do want to say that after we received the announcement, we at CJA received Judge Jarre's announcement. I immediately convened a conference call with the past five presidents of CJA, to include Judge Kaufman. And all of those five advised me that we needed to take some immediate action. I then convened a conference call with my executive committee, and they seconded that we move forward. And that led to the letter that I sent to the governor's office, and which expressed our disagreement with the understanding of the Department of Finance, and ask that the plain language of the statute be addressed once again. I do want to just read a small portion of that letter. I wrote, "Trial courts did not and do not like the elimination of fund balances. As is well known, these accounts allow bridge financing necessary to keep judicial branch business going. That money is used to pay bills, salaries, and to fund essential services used by the judiciary to provide access to justice for Californians' citizens. The compromise reached with your office and the legislature earlier this year, allowing the branch 2 years to spend down its balances, was necessary to avert catastrophic consequences of a one-year elimination plan. As we pointed out during negotiations of this year's budget, 1 year did not give courts sufficient time to adequately prepare for the change without drastically affecting the ability of courts to carry out their core functions. Nothing has changed in the last 6 months, and CJA remains unclear as to the sudden change proposed by your office. Elimination of fund balances, as you now propose, will cripple branch operations. We believe that this puts us on the precipice, really, of a constitutional crisis. We understand the need to wait and see what the official rollout will be on January 10th, but we pledge to all the judges and on behalf of all the judges let you know that we're ready to assist in any legislative or executive branch lobbying that needs to take place, any educational programs, anything that we can do to assist to make sure that this branch is adequately funded. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Hardcastle. Alan Carlson.
Thank you, Chief. Members of the council, I think it's important to remember also that the reserves that the courts had were not just serving a cash flow function, which is very important and significant, and allowing us a glide down, but it also provided a pool of resources that people could use in courts to spend money to save money, so to speak. And once that's fully eliminated, we've lost the opportunity to do that, and in order to do something in the future, we would have to not hire people, lay off people, or do something to be able to accumulate funds to be able to implement some sort of a savings elsewhere. And that's unfortunate because I think a lot of courts have taken a pretty good advantage of what we've had to do the last couple of years to become more electronic, to get more electronic records, the electronic filing, and dealing with other programs, that it's going to be pretty difficult to do once the reserves are gone and we're stuck with 1% at the local level. I also want to acknowledge we do a lot of advanced planning in the courts, and we do appreciate the knowledge that this might happen to allow us to begin planning in the eventuality that it does. I understand we're in negotiation period, but it still helps to have as much knowledge as possible about what the options might be or what the outcomes might be to plan ahead, because we're down to nickels and dimes and really being very careful about doing things. In terms of the impacts of this, I think basically what Judge Jarre and others have mentioned about what might happen is just going to happen on a wider scale, and it's going to be accelerated if further cuts happen in the budget. In discussions with my colleagues over the last week, it's pretty horrifying to hear what kinds of things we're going to have to start doing much sooner if this happens. And so everybody's hoping it doesn't at some level. So, thank you.
Judge Earl? One thing I should also mention is that the unintended consequence of this is trial courts throughout the state are having to determine what are our core functions, what are we mandated to do, and anything we're not mandated to do, and anything that's not a core function, we have to eliminate because we have to prioritize our services. The impact of that, however, is to reduce or eliminate very important programs like self-help centers or attorney referral services, things that are desperately needed by the litigants throughout the state. So that should not go unnoticed.
Right. And also things that you described that Alan Carlson just said, those are things we spend money to save money to provide access. And we mean meaningful access to the folks who are not able to hire counsel, which is the vast majority of people in courts these days. Thank you, Alan. Also now we'll hear from Kurt Soderlund.
So one other, excuse me, Chief, one other piece of information was on December 4th, we met face-to-face with the Department of Finance at the same meeting where the PJs and CEOs from Los Angeles, Sacramento, Santa Clara, Shasta, San Diego, and Yolo. The meeting lasted for 2.5 hours. The primary purpose was to talk about the cash flow issues, but it did eventually morph over into fund balance issues also. We believe the opportunity was provided for each of the courts to make a short presentation to the Department of Finance detailing problems that were going to occur at the local level given this current set of circumstances. my sense, and I would ask of Judge Earle and Judge Rosenberg and others that were there, was the fact that at least there was some kind of a tacit acknowledgement by finance that there definitely were going to be cash flow issues and that there would be an opportunity to get back and have further discussions with the Department of Finance on what remedies might be made available to the branch.
Thank you. Judge Earle?
I think it was a good discussion. I think that there was a point in time, however, where we had to make the distinction between a resource issue and a cash flow issue and make sure they understood the difference. And I hope that we got there.
Judge Rosenberg.
We did limit as best we could our discussion just to cash flow issues, which are huge for the trial courts. And I, for one, believe that the representatives of the Department of Finance who are there got it. I mean, you have to get it. Facts are facts. And the cash flow issues are serious. So we conveyed that. And assuming they get it and that it is passed along to their superiors, I'm hopeful that we can find a solution.
Thank you. Any comments? This isn't an action item, but it's certainly one for comment and question. Judge Jarr.
Just as a perspective and following on what Alan Carlson, who was also there then, recalls, when the trial court funding law, the Lockyer-Eisenberg law, was passed, on which we both, among many, worked, the concept of fund balances was viewed as a demonstration of progressivity in government budgeting. Up to that point in time, the horror stories had to do with agencies or entities discovering they had a few dollars left in the pot at the end of the year and so spent them rather than having them swept back. The use of fund balances discourages that sort of behavior, but it also encourages long-term planning because, as Alan indicated, notwithstanding the crucial cash flow component of the maintenance of fund balances, one actually can, through accumulated savings, launch projects which save more and or enhance the access that the public receives, sometimes simply with programs that are put in place at the public counter. Each of us has examples. I know that one of the examples that was given at the meeting to which Kurt Soderlund referred was an example by the court executive officer of my former court, which embarked early on a very progressive collections program. Having taken that responsibility from our county at the time that trial court funding went into place, it has become a collector now for six other courts, charges a reasonable fee for collection, and has enhanced dramatically the collections that those courts previously experienced. Not one general fund dollar is spent on our collections operation. It is not budgeted. It operates, and the people who serve in that office function based upon the fee that's charged to collect for the other courts. That program, heaven forbid, it goes away, would be among the first to go away for the reason that Judge Earle indicated. We can't prioritize in the branch. Unlike the University of California and the state university systems, we can't simply turn away admissions. We have to take all the business that comes in the door, and we have no control over the volumes, nor of the case type subcategories, because a district attorney may file one way in one county and another district attorney may file another way in another county. So where do you cut when you have to cut? Collections. Well, for heaven's sakes, you have a cascade of revenue reduction associated with cuts that are among the very first that you have to make. And these, of course, are revenues that don't just get generated for the courts by any means. They go by law, and I might add, by the most complicated of laws that I've ever come across in 25 years of service in the branch, to states, coffers, to county coffers, to city coffers. The last number that I got is that our collections activities statewide aggregate to $1.7 billion. So those are the first things that are at risk. The last thing that we can afford to have at risk is the first thing we must put at risk. So I certainly support Alan Carlson's point, but it can't be underemphasized how important the cash flow side of reserve maintenance is. We have very significant programs associated with family. AB 1058 commissioners, a huge advancement in family law protection of children who are in circumstances of financial need. Well, that's a grant-funded program, and it begins at the federal government. But the courts have to front the costs of paying the commissioner and the staff and have the lights turned on in the department and so forth. And then they wait for months to be reimbursed. Those fund balances cover that cash flow problem. So when it comes to the issue of making payroll with a 1% fund balance, Evan, help us. Thank you.
Senator Evans.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Just a little bit of legislative perspective, if I might weigh in. And there's two points that I'd like to make. One, the first point being, and I know probably you've already heard me say this many times, the fiscal and financial landscape of the state has really changed over the last 5 years. And every state agency has had to make had to go through the same analysis and the same struggle that you all are doing right now. And a lot of times the decisions that we have had to make have been a choice among an array of bad decisions, many of them very similar to what you've just discussed, decisions that actually in the long term and even sometimes in the short term are not cost effective. And that's just to bring a little bit of perspective to say that schools for the last 3 to 4 to 5 years actually have been struggling with many of the same kinds of decisions that you are. Reserves have been swept. There haven't been enough funds to go around. There haven't been the ability to make decisions that actually make some common sense. And that's not to give anybody any comfort, but just to say that, put it in perspective, all of us have been struggling with these same kinds of decisions over the last several years. And I think that this year we have actually hit bottom, and now we are starting on the upward swing. So this is going to be a tough year, and there's a lot of difficult decisions to be made. But I do think in the next year to 2 years we're going to be starting to look at a better fiscal picture, the judicial branch included.
You are the only participant in the conference. Please press any key on your keypad to remain in conference.
I often feel like I'm speaking only to myself. The second point I wanted to make is that while there is cause for alarm, I don't think it's a time to panic quite yet. The word that you've been getting is from the Department of Finance only. And the Department of Finance is stepping out a bit ahead of everybody else. And that actually is their role. But this proposal has not yet been vetted by the governor's office, nor has it been vetted by the legislature. So the governor will not be actually bringing forth his his proposal for this coming year until January. So it's a little bit premature at this point, but I would recommend, and I know that you're already in the process of trying to do this, making sure that every single judge in this state contacts his or her assembly member or senator and tells them specifically, and I have letters from all of my court my superior courts already, tells them specifically exactly what this will do to their financial picture and what this will do to their services in the coming year. I can't stress enough how important that is, because ultimately the negotiations are going to happen between the legislature and the governor, and it's absolutely essential that your representatives in the legislature understand what this means.
Thank you, Senator Evans. Always appreciative of your insight and sharing your comments with us. Thank you very much. I think Justice Miller.
And I appreciate that last comment, because I wanted to commend the three of you. I was on many of the phone calls over the last week, and you were diligently getting the information out to all of those different constituents that you represent. You were putting in the process of gathering the exact information that Senator Evans has indicated, and you were ready to activate, again, your constituency to make those contacts. So you should all be commended. I know you were long on the telephone, long in discussions, many days and evenings, so I just wanted to commend you for that.
I want to say one thing to make the point that sometimes seems to be less be overlooked in the process of why one of the reasons the judicial branch is so different from the other funded entities, and that is because we do enforce the laws that are passed by the legislature, well, the governor, signed into law by the governor. And in our meeting with the governor, it was pointed out, as we've said throughout the state, that we, as Steve said, do not control our caseload. And many important substantive civil and criminal laws come out of the legislature that seek to protect Californians. And those are enforced in the court. And in our discussions with the governor, I raised the fact that a very substantive and important critical piece of legislation was passed and signed into law. That is the Homeowners Bill of Rights. It creates over 40 different private causes of action, all important and necessary to protect the most basic of human rights, and that is a person's home. And at the same time, we know that those causes of action, if pursued, will likely be pursued in the poorest or most impoverished counties in the state. And that those counties, those courts in those counties, are least equipped financially to be able to absorb new causes of action in a timely way in order to provide any type of solace or relief to those homeowners who will be out of their home with their families. And that we are different because though we've been cut 30% in the last 5 years, our caseloads continue to be robust and grow as a result of important laws that need to be enforced. So to me, it's like there's a great big hole in the bag. And we are trying to provide what Californians, in my view, believe righteously so as their birthright, the right to go to court to protect their rights, to utilize and enforce the important laws that our legislature passes and the governor signs into law. But the judicial branch is woefully unable to hold up its mandate if we're not adequately funded to enforce these important rights, civil and criminal. But I am so exceptionally worried about what's happening to civil, where most of the private rights are enforced and protected in terms of individual citizens. So this is an ongoing dialogue we have to have, and we stand poised to influence, if we can, the governor's budget before January 10th, and thereafter. Senator Evans, you'll be seeing us many times and often. Thank you.
It will be a pleasure.
Thank you. Any more discussion before we move on? Yes, Ms. Davis.
Some of the feedback that those of us who have participated with the Bench Bar Coalition over the years have gotten from the legislature is that when we do go to Sacramento to advocate for funding issues, which in the past have not been as serious as what potentially faces us on January 10th, one thing that we have been told is how, as Senator Evans was just saying, how the legislature and the governor's office are forced to make impossible decisions and between other social services and children in public schools. And it has occurred to me, and indeed some of the members of the legislature have told us, that with some of these issues it would be valuable to have people from outside the judiciary and even outside our partners in the legal profession participate in the advocacy efforts. And particularly, I think, with the civil litigation, there are going to be HIV-positive workers who are laid off, who are going to be unable to have their day in court to sue for unequal treatment. Children with special education needs are going to be unable to have their parents get redressed in the courts. The countless victims of elder abuse and fraud, many of which go to the civil justice system. And there are nonprofit organizations. There are ways of reaching out to non-attorneys, non-judges, who can tell their stories, and I think this time around it might be important to do that.
Thank you, Angela. Justice Baxter?
Yes, one source for that would be CSAC, because I know in those counties like Fresno, and I'm sure other counties as well, when the court made the decision to close all of the rural courts, the members of the Board of Supervisors that lost courts in their districts, resulting in their constituents having to drive for hours in order to adjudicate either a civil or a criminal issue. It was there was a lot of political pushback from the supervisors. So I think that's a good example of another organization that would be very helpful in making the case on behalf of the citizens within the county.
Thank you. Judge Rosenberg.
Just wanted to reemphasize one point, and that is the impact on law enforcement, police, sheriffs, CHP. When situations are delayed, for example, in traffic court, if there are delays, which there will be, if people have to travel long distances, which is happening, then law enforcement personnel just can't attend. They can't be sitting there in a lobby for 3 or 4 hours after driving for an hour and a half and basically waste an entire day waiting for a case to be called. And so we've already seen some of this. They just don't attend. And so the case is dismissed. So pretty soon people get the notion that, well, I'm going to contest this. I'm going to demand a trial, knowing that ultimately the case will be dismissed. And so how does that aid justice? There are many things wrong with that scenario.
Thank you. Ms. Davis, then Justice Hall.
Just another comment about the advocacy piece. There's a parallel crisis happening in nonprofit organizations right now that are struggling for funding. And one of the discussions that I've heard several times is how people do remember the stories of the individual. Many of us remember years ago there was a child who fell down some well, and it was on national television prime time. This one child who fell down a well, and could she be rescued, and could her life be saved? And many people, if given the opportunity, would have sent money, would have done anything to save that one child. And in the meantime, there are millions of children in Africa and other places of the world that are dying because there are not enough mosquito nets to cover them and protect them from malaria. What I'm suggesting is that as part of this advocacy effort, both from the courts and also if we enlist the support of nonprofit organizations, if people could try to tell one specific story and maybe get individuals to tell their stories in some type of media format, I think it might make for a more compelling presentation if we can do that and then say, and this is just one example of the 50,000 cases in this county that have been delayed for 1 year or more.
Thank you, Angela. Justice Hull?
Thank you, Chief. All of the concerns that have been expressed are obviously legitimate, but I think that in addition to those and our focus on those who cannot afford representation, those unfortunates who need the courts to protect them, that we also need to recognize that, especially with the closure of the civil courts, which is taking place, that this potentially, and I think predictably, may have a long-term effect on the health of the economy in California, in that when we think of access to justice, which is one of the primary subjects of the trial court funding work group that I'm a member of, oftentimes we forget that access to justice is also necessary for business and private interests to settle their business disputes in the state, for individuals and private enterprise to settle their real estate disputes in the state, and all of the broad range of matters that affect the attractiveness of the state as a place to live and do business. There was a very compelling op-ed piece that I know many of us have seen by the president of the Los Angeles County Bar Association recently, where he pointed out those very great concerns that also need to be taken into account in any long-range planning that affects the ability of the courts to resolve the broad range of disputes that arise daily in this vast state. And so access to justice means access to justice for everybody up and down the spectrum, including access to justice for business and private enterprise. Winston Churchill once described private enterprise as the horse that pulls the cart. and I'm not singling them out or private enterprise for any special treatment, but I'm trying to convey the sense that access to justice is a concept that is critical to the long-term health of the state and the well-being of the citizens of the state.
Edie Mathai.
Just to follow up on that briefly, when the Open Courts Coalition held a rally in downtown Los Angeles, one of the most powerful statements was made by the head of a construction workers union who had a situation in which there was about to be a very problematical labor issue on a construction job. And as a result of the ability of the union to get the redress of the courts promptly, that was diffused. And his description of the, and this was not a polite dispute. Threats were made, physical violence that his description made sound quite real. And so we often hear the stories of the families that are affected if they can't get to court, or the individuals. But as Justice Hall commented, it is also important to the businesses of our state that when they need to stop a situation that could have easily gotten completely out of hand, there is a court to issue the order that can make that happen.
Thank you. Judge Ellsworth.
Well, coming from Riverside County, I think I can speak not in anticipation, but having lived through an era where we completely shut down civil. And I can tell you what it does to a court, what it does to a community, what it does to an entire county. Not only is there a change in the balance that we so carefully work towards and between litigants, plaintiffs, defendants, it's all out of whack when we take away the right to come to court to be able to get their cases heard promptly. There are horror stories that are true, horror stories about medical malpractice cases where children have been left in a situation where they are now being cared for by parents and there's no reprieve financially for them to care for their child. There are construction cases such as you've spoken of. There are businesses that shut down. There are individuals held hostage because defense knows that they don't have to go to trial, won't go to trial, and there's no open door. So we've lived through it, and it's taken us all this time to start to dig out of it spoonful by spoonful, not only financially, but I would say to the core, the morale of an entire county. When processes aren't put in place to be able to utilize courts, we are not a state agency. We are a third branch of government. And when we effectively close our doors to an entire population, civil, for example, like we had to do, we are a broken branch. We are not a broken state agency or an underfunded state agency. We are a branch that is not able to effectively do what we are entitled to do.
I know this is an ongoing subject. We appreciate all the comments and the work that's being done and will continue to be done. Thank you for presenting today.
You are the only participant in the conference. Please press any key on your keypad to remain in conference.
I'm feeling isolated.
Perfect timing.
Every once in a while. I'll figure out. Secret economy.